The Jeep Grand Cherokee 4xe plug-in hybrid is built for the best of both worlds. For the city buzz, for the call of the wild, for finding solitude, for sharing memories, for day trips, and for far-roaming adventures. Because with gas and electric capability, the Jeep Grand Cherokee 4xe inspires you to explore more, to explore it all. Tap the banner to learn more. Jeep is a registered trademark of FCA US LLC.
There's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello, Paddy. Are you with us?
Yes, thank you very much.
Hello, everyone. This is Colin Schindler, along with John Holmes and Patrick Barkley, welcoming you back to another edition of Football Ruined My Life. And this week, we're going to be talking to the Baron Grade of Yarmouth, who has, at various points in my television career, been my boss, although as director of programmes at London Weekend Television, and later as controller of BBC One, he was so superior to my status as a humble producer of drama series that I dare say he was entirely unaware of my existence. However, for all the company directorships and his elevation to the House of Lords, we meet on equal footing as football fans, because his admirably steadfast passion down the years has been for Charlton Athletic FC. At LWT, he orchestrated the infamous snatch of the day, when clever little ITV, under his skillful guidance, nipped the ball off the giant lumbering centre-half that was the BBC. A mighty roar went up from the dozy giant, and ITV had to return the programme with a certain amount of understandable irritation that it hadn't been rewarded for its now, and I use that untranslatable Yiddish word, chutzpah. Michael, our listeners will be intrigued to know that you started your career not in the world of your Uncle Lou and your father Leslie Grade, who founded the country's leading theatrical agency, but as a trainee sports journalist on the Daily Mirror. Now, how did that happen?
Well, I left school at 17. I didn't want to go to university. And my dad, who shared my passion for sport, football in particular, managed to wangle me a job as a trainee sports writer at the Daily Mirror. The fact that the Daily Mirror were big shareholders in the family business was neither here nor there.
Where, of course, you came under the wing of the late lamented great Brommers, of course.
Brommers and I were lifelong friends. We were colleagues at the Mirror, and then we were colleagues at London Weekend Television, where he was head of sport.
I should explain that John Bromley was much admired and much liked by everybody with whom he came into contact. It was Brommers who took me on as a trainee on the World Cup of 1974. You know, that was the start of my career, A, in television, and B, in sport. I mean, he created the most wonderful department, an atmosphere that was a joy to be in.
Well, that was Bromley. He was a party animal, and he had a joy of life. I went to visit him in hospital when he was dying of cancer, and I got to his room. There was a big sign on it. It said, "Nil by mouth. Silence, please." And I tapped at the door and I went in. There was a party going on. Red wine and champagne. Everyone smoking. Nil by mouth. That was Brommers. God rest his soul. Brommers.
And he orchestrated Snatch of the Day, I think, with you. Wasn't that right?
Yeah, we did it together. I was very friendly with the chairman of the Football League, Jack Dunnett, who was the chairman of Brentford and later Notts County. And between Brommers and me and Alan Hardacre and Jack Dunnett, we snatched Match of the Day from the BBC.
It didn't turn out to be entirely successful.
Well, it was all part of a grand strategy. In those days, there were only three channels. And where the BBC had 20 cameras at the cup final, we had 20 cameras at the cup final. But we were always on a hiding to nothing because of the ad breaks, and the audience wouldn't tolerate that on live sport. So we wanted to get a deal with the BBC where we would alternate the cup final, the Olympic Games, the World Cup, and things like that. So we would all save money and so on, but they wouldn't agree. Why would they? They were the winners anyway. So we thought if we got match of the day, we could use it as leverage in a deal with the BBC, which is exactly what happened. We created an alternation programme agreement with the BBC.
Bromwich claimed to me later on that he felt highlights programmes didn't work on ITV. The time later on when they did capture the rights to Match of the Day, they put it on earlier and it actually bombed, didn't it?
Well, it was on too early. It was ridiculous scheduling. You come in after the pub on a Saturday night, or if you're a Charlton fan, the game finished at 5, you get home about 10:30. So they scheduled it wrong. They didn't know what to do with it. Hopeless.
So tell us about the passion for Charlton. You weren't born in South East London, were you?
No, I was born in Chelsea, in the Chelsea Hospital for Women, it says on my birth certificate. My dad was the agent for Billy Cotton and his band, which some of your listeners might remember. Mm. And Billy Cotton, his closest friends were the Glixtons, who owned Charlton. And my dad would go anywhere to watch a football game. Eventually, he settled on Leighton Orient, became a director of Leighton Orient. But he would go anywhere for a game. And Bill said to him, come to Charlton. You know, we'll be guests of the Glixtons. And let's bring young Michael with you. So I was 7 years old, about 1950, 51. And I saw Charlton play Portsmouth. And that was it for life.
And presumably the Valley still had that enormous bank of terraces.
Yeah, it was before they invented health and safety. Mm-hmm. And the record crowd, they think, was about 82,000. For a midweek cup replay with the Arsenal. But there were no controls in those days, and we had this vast amphitheatre.
And when you started, were the crowds still big for Charlton?
Yeah, 20,000. And I used to bunk off school on a Saturday. I went to a day school in South London. I get a 75 bus to the Valley, walk down the hill from the top, and go and see Charlton play. And we would get 15, 20,000 in those days.
Yeah, it's fair to say, if any club had their sort of great years ruined by the war, it was Charlton.
Oh, no question.
You were second in the league just before, then you were in the cup final, then you won the cup.
Well, let me add to that. Jimmy Seed, the manager, took Charlton pre-war from the third division south to the second division to the first division in successive seasons. Mm. And in the third of those seasons, we nearly won the title. It's unheard of, that progress in such a short space of time.
Who were the great players of that era?
Sam Bartram was the standout,
goalkeeper, yeah.
Who I saw play on that first game and became quite friendly with him because he was a journalist. He used to do football reports for the People on a Sunday. So I got to know Sam a bit. He was a lovely man. He was the biggest star.
579 appearances, according to this.
He was fantastic. He was the bravest keeper you've ever seen. I mean, he was just amazing. And then a little bit later, in the 50s and 60s, the biggest transfer at the time in the history of the game was Eddie Firmani from Charlton to Italy. He was the first of the great British footballers to go to Italy. He was actually, because his name ended in a vowel, he was allowed to play for Italy in the World Cup.
He was from South Africa, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was originally South African. Today, you'd have said he was Alan Shearer. He was that kind of a player. He was a magical, magical player.
He came back to Charlton because I remember seeing him in the mid-60s playing for Charlton at May.
Yeah, he came back and it was hysteria at the Valley when he came back. Everyone was so thrilled. It was a strange time. Three or four of the first team of Charlton in the 60s, in the summer, they played county cricket for Kent.
Yeah. No, that's right.
Stuart Leary.
Dale Gufton. Stuart Leary, who was my all-time favourite player. John Huey didn't play cricket, but he was picked, selected on the team sheet in every position for Charlton, including goalkeeper.
Wow.
Every single position. And when he came out as a goalkeeper against Brighton, I'll never forget it, he did quite well, actually. And just before half-time, somebody in the crowd, Huey, shouted, you've got to go off, mate. You've got to get changed. You're in the band at half time. He played for Scotland.
At left back for Scotland, that's right. I remember.
But it's fair. Jimmy Seed, I mean, was manager for 23 years.
Yeah.
And then was he sacked the season you went down or the season before?
A couple of seasons before that. He was past his sell-by date.
Right.
And Jimmy Trotter, his trainer, became the manager. Wonderful story about Jimmy Trotter. I was a kid, I was 15, and we were playing Aston Villa at Aston Villa midweek. under floodlights. I thought, well, this is, I've not seen many floodlights. So I go up to Villa on the train and we lose 11-1, okay, at Villa Park on a rainy night.
Narrow defeat.
Jerry Hitchens, who played for England and played in Italy, scored 5 goals. Anyway, we're 5-1 down, okay, after about 20 minutes. And our goalkeeper, Willie Duff, is carried off on a stretcher, no substitute. So Stuart Leary went in goal and ended up 11-1. So I'm on the train coming back, and the team's on the train, and Jimmy Trotter's there, and I knew Jimmy a bit. So to make conversation, I said, how's Willie, the goalkeeper, who was carried off? Oh, he said, he'll be all right for Saturday. Oh, I said, he didn't break anything. No, he said, he went off with a broken heart. We were playing against Everton, I think, in a cup replay. And Dave Hickson was playing for Everton, who was a big, rough, tough, very physical, the most physical centre-forward I've ever seen. And he and Willie were at it up at Everton. And when they came down to the Valley for the replay, Willie decided it was revenge time. So the first corner they got, the ball comes over, Willie comes flying out of his goal, miles away from the ball, with the sole intention of punching Dave Hickson on the jaw, which he did. And Hickson goes flat on his back on the ground. And Willie does the same, takes his jersey off, gives it to somebody else and walks off the field. And the referee's calling him back. He says, I'm going, I'm going. The other great night at the... Sorry about these anecdotes. The other great night, we had 2 players sent off in a cup replay, our centre-forward and our inside left, Derek Hales and Mike...
Flanagan.
They had a fight in the centre circle, our own 2 players. They both got sent off for fighting. We ended the match with 9 players. We were just laughing. We couldn't believe what we were seeing.
Did that happen with Bowyer and...
Kieran Dyer.
But it wasn't just funny. The way Michael describes it is comic.
It also happened with David Batty and Graham Lasseau. I think in those days, at the times that Michael is describing and in the place he's describing, you can see the joke. I don't think the press saw the joke when Batty and
Lasseau. One of the greatest memories I've got, we were talking about John Bromley. And Brommers and I, we covered the European Cup final, the Champions League as it is today. We're sitting in the hotel having a cup of tea, and it was Nottingham Forest and Malmo.
Yeah.
And Cluffy came through the lounge. Oh, he said, hello, young Bromley, young Gray. He said, where are you sitting? So Bromley's got the tickets out, ZZ something. No, you're not. He said, you're coming with me. Anyway, we went on the coach with the team, police escort into the stadium, and sat on the touchline on the bench with Cluffy and watched Nottingham Forest win the European Cup. What a memory.
He wasn't drinking then, probably, Michael, was he?
I wouldn't like to say. I don't know. Nobody's ever explained why he was a drinker.
I think it was out of self-loathing of what he'd become and the money and so on. He sort of turned on himself later on. But I went to that game as well in the Olympic Stadium, wasn't it? And the rare header from Trevor Francis.
I remember it well. On a sad note about Cluffy, Alan Bleasdale, the TV dramatist, was working on Kenny Dalglish's autobiography. It never got published. He didn't finish it. Kenny didn't want to finish it. But Alan told me the story that at the Hillsborough disaster, there is no quote, no photograph, and no footage of Cluffy, who was the opposing manager. And Kenny Dalglish told Alan that he, Kenny Dalglish, had seen the state Cluffy was in, that they put him on a stretcher, covered him over, did smuggle him out of the stadium.
Yeah.
He was in such a state.
The book, The Damned United, although I think in time sequence it was wrong, I think it was brilliant in capturing a lot of the essence of the character of what he became, Clough.
Yes.
Because he was the time that you would have known him, and he was magic on TV
when
he first came on the panels and everything else.
I saw him play for
Middlesbrough or Sunderland.
I saw him play for Middlesbrough. He had no pace, but his positional sense and his finishing and everything was brilliant. But he was so outspoken. In those days, the England team was picked by the selectors, can you believe? Alf Ramsey was the first manager allowed to pick the team. And because he was so mouthy, Cluffy, they never picked him for England. He should have been a natural centre-forward for him.
He did play a game.
Yeah.
One or two.
And then, of course, he had that injury. He was injured out of the game. I don't think they looked after him, but he emerged as a great manager at Derby. But then, of course, he fell out with Derby.
How do you think he would have fared in today's football, Michael? A man as outspoken as that?
I think he'd be brilliant. Good copy.
Well, good copy. But, you know, the rules of the Premier League and the rest of it are so...
He would have been outspoken. There are always outspoken managers, you know. There are some who will gob off, you know, and he would have been one of those. But he'd have been too valuable to the game to have done anything about it. And do you know that his teams and Bill Shankly's teams never, ever, ever, ever questioned a referee?
Quite right.
I remember going to interview Bill Shankly for the first time Liverpool got into the European Cup. It was open, quotes, open day at Anfield. And we're all in the car park, all at the Daily Express, the Mirror, you know, all the papers. There's a ball, and we're kicking the ball about in the car park. And Shankly kept us waiting. Eventually comes out. He went absolutely apeshit. If you want to play football, Sonny, I'll get you stripped off. We'll do it properly. Christ, and he gave us all a bollocking. I thought we were going to have to strip off and get into kit and go and play properly, which none of us was fit enough to do. The idea of people not taking football seriously was just so offensive to him.
So Charlton after Seed sort of really faded away.
I always said I've supported them through thin and thin.
Yeah. Basically. It must have been the occasional thick.
Well, when we got into the Premiership, I was on the board by that time. And we had a fabulous run. We got relegated quite quickly, but we came back very, very quickly and stayed up for a good few years, thanks to Alan Kirbishley, who was just a brilliant manager. He was just an amazing picker of players.
Yes.
I mean, he bought Clive Mendonca for 750,000 quid and got a hat-trick at Wembley in the playoff against Sunderland, got us up into the Premiership. He'd been available to anybody and he bought him. He spotted him. Absolutely phenomenal.
Was it always your ambition to go on the board?
No. It was quite hard because you can't emote if you're in the director's box. You have to sit quietly and suck it up, you know. Jasper Carrot used to do a wonderful routine about, because he's Birmingham City Blues fan. He said, me and my chum, we go to Old Trafford and I've got very good seats. We're right in amongst the Man U fans. And to our astonishment, he said, we scored. At which point, he said, my chum jumped up screaming his head off. He said, I punched him in the face. And he sat down. He said, what do you do that for? He said, I'm saving your life.
It must have been around Michael's time in the boardroom at Charlton and Alan Kirbishley running the team. I remember Scott Parker and Matty Holland, who I thought was a super player for you.
Yeah,
it was a good team all round. And I think you finished in the top half or thereabouts for a...
Seven.
Yeah. For all these seasons in a row, and basically you were hailed as a well-run club, you know, and a good example to maybe the, some of the so-called bigger clubs around them. It's not been quite like that since, though, has it?
No, we've had a succession of managers and a succession of owners. You know, it's not been a great period of stability, let me say. It's been a rough old run. We seem to have got a good team of people now running the club who seem committed and have some experience in football.
I noticed Paul Elliott's back. Is that right?
The Belgian owner, Mr. de Châtelet, who still owns the ground, when he took over the club, Chrissy Power was the manager, and he was at the training ground at Sparrows Lane on a Thursday, packing up. He sees this guy in a raincoat with a suitcase, looking lost. So he goes up and says, hello. He says, can I help you? And the guy said, yes, I'm looking for, he looks at his piece of paper, Monsieur Chris Parry. He said, oh, I'm Chris Powell. I'm the manager of the club here. What can I do for you? Oh, he said, Mr. de Châtelet sent me. I'm the goalkeeper for Saturday. It was at that point, I think, Chris Powell knew his days were numbered. It's absolutely true, that story. He just couldn't make it up, could he? Only at Charlton. Now, I'm going to tell you, the greatest game of football ever played, professional football in this country, was played at the Valley in February 1957 or
7-6.
Oh, you've done the tag.
No, tell us.
It was a mid-table second division, which is the Championship today. Charlton and Huddersfield, a meaningless fixture, small pre-Christmas crowd, and we are 5-1 down with 20 minutes to go and 10 men, no subs in those days. Derek Ufton had gone off with yet another dislocated shoulder. And 5-2, 5-3... 5-4, 5-5. In 20 minutes, this is. Then Huddersfield score. We're now 6-5 down. We get it back to 6-6. The last kick of the game, we win 7-6. Mm. And a wonderful player called Johnny Summers got 5 goals that afternoon. Mm. And he was on Sports Report at 5 o'clock. And Eamon Andrews had him on the phone. He said, Johnny, said, you were 5-1 down with 10 men and 20 minutes to go. What did you think? He said, I thought, blow your whistle, ref. Let's all go home. But it taught everyone a lesson. Never leave the game before the end. Yeah. Never.
Just on the subject of great matches, more recently, the Mendonca match that you sort of alluded to, that was quite something, wasn't it?
Yeah, we won 4-3. Clive got a fabulous, fabulous hat-trick. When you see it again, his touch in front of goal was just magical.
You got promoted.
Yeah, we got into the Premiership, yeah. The best day in the Premiership, I go to Highbury, I look at the Arsenal team sheet, Bergkamp, Henry, you name it, they're all in there. Oh, my God. Anyway, we didn't get the ball for 20 minutes. All I can remember is Aston Villa 11-1. It's all that's going through my mind. We ended up winning 4-2.
Good Lord.
And David Dean, who was at the Arsenal then, said to me in the boardroom afterwards, he said, well, I've never seen a game like that, Michael. Well done. He said, you had one chance and scored 4 goals. Everything we touched went in. It was just madness.
But there was also that fantastic playoff game against Sunderland, wasn't there? That ended up with penalties that went on into
forever. Yeah, well, that was at Wembley.
But it was 4-4 after extra time and then went to...
Yeah, oh, endless. We had one or two players who were trying not to make eye contact. Yeah. Who was the manager, as he's doing the list. And I remember John Robinson, who was a winger, being dragged, dragged to go and take it. And he scored, to our amazement. And we had a goalkeeper called Sasha Ilić, who got very badly hurt in a game at Chelsea the following season in the Premiership. And never really recovered. He could save anything. He was magical. He was a bit like those of you who might remember Tony Macedo.
No, of course.
Who played for Fulham. Gibraltar, yes. Goalkeeper. Yes. Incredibly athletic and a fantastic shot saver, but prone to the odd mistake. I remember going to Fulham one night to see Chelsea play Fulham. And Jimmy Greaves was playing for Chelsea and Tony Macedo was in goal for Fulham. And Tosh Chamberlain, who was a wonderful Cockney character, on Fulham's left wing. And the Fulham chairman was a great old comedian called Tommy Trinder. And Tommy's in the director's box, very close to the pitch. And Macedo makes a save of a lifetime. Nobody could believe how he got to the ball. And he's bouncing the ball as they used to in those days. And he's looking at him, Tosh Chamberlain, right in front of the director's box on the halfway line. And Macedo rolls the ball out. Like they do today. They didn't used to do that. He was quite ahead of his time. And he rolled it straight to Jimmy Greaves, who knocked it past him. The goal. At which point, Tosh lay down on the touchline, looked up at Tommy Trinder in a very loud voice, said, what up? See you next Tuesday. What up? The place fell about.
You've never wavered in your support for Charlton.
Never. You can't. My oldest son, Jonathan, he goes to all the away games, just fanatical. And his kid is now going to all the games. It's in the DNA of the family now.
Correct. I think one of the themes of our podcast is how clubs are in your DNA.
Yes.
It's one of the duties, isn't it, of a father to pass on. I can remember having a go at Gary Lineker about his eldest son being a Man U fan. And I said, you're a disgrace. You failed as a father.
Yeah, completely.
The consequence, he then concentrated, and the other three, he's got four boys, the other three are, of course, Leicester
City, now. Right too. Yeah. But my dad eventually became a director of Leighton Orient, and they got up, they had a manager, brilliant manager, who was ex-Everton, Johnny Carey, who played fullback in the great Manchester United team of the 50s. Yeah. And Johnny Carey famously got fired as the Everton manager in the back of a taxi by John Moores.
Yes.
Famous. Anyway, he arrives at Leighton Orient and he gets him promoted with a mix of youth players and I won't say has-beens, that's very unfair, but people that had peaked at their big clubs.
Yeah.
And he got them promoted. They did all right the first few games. Then the wheels came off, as you expect. My dad called a board meeting and he said, Johnny, he said, how much will it take to keep this team in the first division? And Johnny Carey puffed his pipe and says, Mr. Grady said, save your money.
Johnny Carey went to Forest, actually, after the Orient.
Right.
I remember the season the Orient got into the first division, Dave Dunmore was the second.
Dave Dunmore, that's right. And Eddie Bailey.
And there was Eddie Lewis, wasn't there?
Lewis at fullback.
Didn't he go from Charlton?
Yes, and Stan Charlton, who came from the Arsenal.
Yes, you're right. They looked pretty outclassed, didn't they, when they got up that time?
Yeah. What are the biggest changes that you've seen over the course of your lifetime in supporting football?
The skill level's gone through the roof.
Yeah.
And the fitness has absolutely gone through the roof. When you see the skills that great hulking centre-backs can now display on the ball, they've got to have that skill on the ball today to make it. The thing I don't like about the modern game, and I would outlaw it, I think there should be a law that says you can't pass backwards in your own half more than twice or three times. This passing out from the back and this refusal to risk losing possession. You know, you see teams have got possession in the opposing penalty area, and the next thing you know, it's back with their goalkeeper.
Yeah.
They've passed it all the way back. That's not entertainment.
No,
well, I
correct.
Agree with you entirely, but isn't that Guardiola's legacy?
It's like the Catenaccio in Italy nearly killed the game. You know, if you want to get rich betting, all you do is bet any Italian team, national or club, to win 1-0. You never go wrong. They always win 1-0 or they lose 1-0. The Catenaccio was that mass defence. That nearly killed the game in Italy. And we're killing the game, this passing in your own half backwards, endlessly.
They're even doing it now, I understand, with teams in the fourth division or second division.
Well, I'm sure school teams are doing it now.
Yeah.
But you're trying to de-risk the game. All sport is about taking risk, isn't it?
Well, although I think they play from the back and they're not good enough to play from the back. And actually, that's how a lot of them give away goals because they get closed down. I also find, like you, Michael, I'm afraid, unless it provides entertainment, it was the highlight of our week, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
On a Saturday, the skills of the players and the excitement that the game generated.
Yes.
And I think at the top level, it still does because the players are good enough. But
absolutely.
You go down through the leagues, I'm afraid a lot of the enjoyment has gone out of it.
Well, bring back the long ball then.
Well, I was about to say that. What we've got now is the reaction to Route One, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah. I think there's a place in the game for it, but it's just overdone now.
Mm. Yeah.
When you throw away a real attacking advantage and you see midfield players with their back to the opposing goal, they never turn. They just give it sideways or backwards. Nobody going forward. Dear, oh, dear, oh, dear. What would Alf Ramsey say? Alf had one quote after every game. If they didn't do well, England, we'd all gather round for the press conference after, and he'd rub his top lip, and he'd always say the same thing over and over. Our passing wasn't good enough.
Mm.
That's all he'd say. Our passing wasn't good enough. Do you know his first game, Alf Ramsey, for England, they lost 5-2 in Paris.
Yeah, they did. Yep.
I was on the Mirror at the time as a sports writer, and the Mirror sports photographer, a great guy called Monty Fresco, no longer with us, come on, he said, we'll go and interview the England goalkeeper who lives at Shepherd's Bush, Ron Springett. He came from QPR and played for Sheffield Wednesday, who were a big club in those days. So we go round to his house, unannounced, and we go into the sitting room, and the England goalkeeper, who just let five in the Stade Colombe in Paris, is sitting watching television, glued up against the screen with thick pebble glasses. Monty said, stay there, Ron, it's a nice picture. Click.
That was his last game, I think. Alf's first move was to bring Gordon Banks in, wasn't it, after that game?
Yeah.
Were you sad to leave the world of sports journalism to move into television?
I'm never sad about what's gone. My dad was very ill and I had to go into the family business is what happened. But I've always carried with me what I learned at the Mirror, you know, as a journalist, learning at the core how newspapers work and learning to write very short, snappy press releases. No press releases when I was in television. Never left my office without the words inserted. Michael Gray said, quote, this is good news for viewers, uncle.
Whatever the news was.
Whatever it was, whatever we were announcing. And it always got quoted. But you learn that as a journalist, so I don't regret it. Being paid to watch sport is, you know, is just beyond a kid's dream if you love sport, love football, and cricket and track and field and the things that I used to cover.
Your favourite player at the time you watched at Charlton?
Charlton players was definitely Stuart Leary, who was a centre-forward, very creative. He was like a cross between sort of Johnny Haynes, fantastic passer of a ball, and a goal scorer, because Johnny Haynes didn't get many goals, but he could make goals, you know, in today's parlance, assist. But Stuart Leary was my all-time. I used to watch him. He was a showman, but he was a fantastic passer of a ball and scored quite a few goals too. He was a magical player to watch.
When you were in charge of London Weekend as director of programmes, you had the Sunday afternoon slot of football.
Yeah, the big match.
Yeah, the big match with Brian Moore, which in a way was very good. But I assume that the snatch of the day was fertilised in the irritation you must have felt at not being able to get onto Saturday night. It's a different watch on a Sunday afternoon.
Well, Sunday afternoon was really about London clubs, mostly. It was what we called a local programme to meet our local quota. So it was all about mostly the London clubs. But match of the day, you know, that appointment on Saturday night at 10:30 was just part of the furniture, wasn't it?
It was, and yeah. Still is.
Yes, it still is. Don't forget, there was virtually no live football in those days on television. You might get the odd international match, maybe a cup match occasionally. Not like today. I mean, most nights you can find a football match on one of the streamers or somewhere. It's great.
Now, I know Paddy has a feeling about the, well, we all do, about the overabundance of football on television.
It hasn't affected the crowds.
Yes.
That was always the fear that it would affect the crowds, but there's no experience like going.
But can it continue at the level that it's at now? Is there not going to come a time when the ratings will fall and the advertisers will disappear and that particular trend will start happening?
I don't think so, because it's not about ratings anymore, because the streamers are not worried about ratings per se, they're worried about subscriptions.
Yeah,
it's a very different game. You know, so, I couldn't do without my subscription so that I can get my football and other sport and cricket. If you're a sports fan, you've got to have it.
It is the ultimate perishable goods, isn't it, Michael?
Match of the day defies gravity because normally people don't want to watch recorded sport because it's an event, it's live, you don't know the outcome, you're desperate to be part of the drama, and the drama goes if you know the result. It's like going to read an Agatha Christie novel and somebody says, oh, that's a good book, that the butler did it. There's no point reading it, is there, really? But that's sport. It's real drama, and it's very hard to match it. And we just have to remember to keep the entertainment level up. I mean, VAR, love it or loathe it, it's a fantastic talking point.
Yes, I agree with you.
And you can't believe how many mistakes they make with the technology. It's just unreal.
And the DRS has improved cricket, I think.
Oh, it's fantastic. You don't mind the wait because it creates suspense.
They've got it down to a relatively quick amount. VAR can actually go on for far, far too long, it seems.
Yeah, and if it takes them that long, then the decision ought to be easy.
Yeah.
But they're getting the hang of it. I wish they'd spend a bit of money improving the quality of referees outside the Premiership. We had a player sent off the other week for nearly having his leg broken by an over-the-ball tackle. Our players poked the ball forward, just got there first. The other guy's come in, nowhere near the ball, studs up across his shin, and our guy gets sent off. Mm. I mean, how do you make mistakes like that?
Who would be a referee, though?
Not
That's
me.
One of the problems. The abuse they take.
I would instruct referees, and I would train them, that when they make a decision and the players come towards them, they never take a step back.
Yeah.
Once you take the step back, it's fatal. They just keep coming and you keep going backwards. You're on the back foot. Mm-hmm. If you stand still, say, go on, boys, knock me over. Go on.
Mm. Shankly and Clough would have said, you don't approach the referee. I mean,
never, ever.
It's
never,
within
ever.
The power of the manager to stop that to begin with.
Yeah.
100%. Couldn't agree with
it's
you more.
It's badly regulated. I mean, what drives me absolutely crackers these days is every time a player so much as feels the wind on his back, he takes a rest and falls down.
And rolls over. Don't forget the rolling
over.
Yeah,
but when they roll over, you know there's absolutely bugger all wrong with them. But if you can roll over, you're not injured. Or writhe. But the referees stop the game. Now, my understanding was unless the guy has a head injury, you don't stop the game. You know, I don't know why they keep stopping the game for what everybody in the ground except the referee knows is a fake injury to stop the counterattack.
Yeah.
Well, that's why they grab their heads. It has become a tactic now.
Yes.
Yeah. If the opposition team are building what looks like an attack, you go down clutching your head and the game has to stop.
What do you guys think about the sin bin idea from rugby?
I think it's a very good idea. My grandson plays hockey. I watch him a lot. Mm. And they have a green card and a yellow card and a red card. So they have 2 minutes in the sin bin, 10 minutes in the sin bin and sent off.
I've never been in favour of it up till now because nowadays coaches can easily coach 10 v 11. In fact, they do. They all coach 10 v 11.
Yeah.
in the expectation that they are going to get a red card at some stage during the season. So you lose a player for 10 minutes, it's absolutely no problem. Two banks of four or four and five, and nothing will happen during that period, except that the spectators will be denied the entertainment we all want. I've had that argument all my life, so I've been against the sin bin. On the other hand, for cheating, like I just described earlier on, I think it would be effective.
It's one of those things. I think it's all right in principle, but as Paddy says, in rugby it makes a lot of difference because they actually lack a man. And since rugby is all about physical might now rather than skill, I think that really does count.
You sound very much like an academic, John. It's all very well in practice, but will it work in theory?
Yes, that's correct. Well, I'm not the academic. Colin's the academic.
Oh, okay.
Another one I would like to see, since we're all coming out with hobby horses, and this will never come in, I know that this would actually improve the game. You know how teams do the take one for the team in rotation? Five players take a yellow card to stop the opposition, and it usually works. I would have team red cards. So if you commit three cynical fouls, the coach has a decision which of those three is going off. Basically, you've got to take somebody off.
How long would they be given to take a decision?
30 seconds, and then the referee decides. Or the manager of the opposing team. Yeah, you, Thierry Henry, off.
Well, Andy Hamilton had a very good idea about the player who dives onto the ground holding his face when he hasn't been touched. Mm. Yeah. The referee gets him to his feet, makes him put his hands behind his back, and the referee knocks him in the face.
Or send him to RADA.
Just introduce a sense of decorum again. In 1992, when the Football League gave way to the Premier League, where were you and what was your feeling at the time about the influence of television on the future of the game? We know what happened. I'm just curious to know what you felt at the time.
I thought it was a brilliant move. A brilliant move by Sam Chisholm, God rest his soul, at Sky.
Yeah.
And David Dean and the team that put it all together. And I think Greg Dyke, to a certain extent, takes some credit. He was Director General of the BBC at the time, I think, or London Weekend, I can't remember.
It was London Weekend,
London Weekend. I thought it was an absolutely brilliant decision to lift the game away from the Blazers, what I call the Blazers, who used to run the game at the FA, and highly professionalise it, market it in a way that needed marketing. And if it took Sky's money to make it happen, terrific.
Well, it rescued Sky, in effect, didn't
Absolutely.
It? Absolutely. I mean, people always say to me, what Sky did for football. On the other hand, what football did for Sky. Because at that point, it was losing £1 million a week.
It was absolutely a visionary move. Rupert Murdoch had never shown any interest in his sport at all. And Sam somehow persuaded him to bet the store on football.
I believe it was the World Cup semi-final when we played Germany in 1990. There were all the pictures of Westminster Bridge being deserted, the M1.
That
apparently was the decisive step. Because you're right. Murdoch had bet everything on films, hadn't he, at that stage?
They had, yes. That was okay, but it wasn't a real driver. No. It was nice to have, but not a driver of revenue. And the way the Premier League was transformed, it's now the league in the world, isn't it?
Of course. What do you think, though, Michael, about the way it's developed subsequently and that now it's evolved into this situation where the teams that go down come straight back up and the teams at the top are trying to go off and almost form their own Super League?
Well, I believe in the free market. And in the end, it's an argument about the culture of British football and the meaning clubs have in the communities and the areas in which they exist and have that history versus the pressure of the market. And a Super League is possibly a very attractive idea. But what do you lose? You lose an awful lot in the process. Yes.
In the end, it'll be about the fans, won't it? Because the fans dictate the shape of the game.
Well, I'm not sure about that. I mean, the fans have got short memories. You know?
They made their feelings very clear when that Super League came up a couple of years ago, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's clear that the architects of it, you know, the Agnellis and the president of Madrid, they were taken aback. And certainly at Manchester United, the Americans were taken aback by the reaction.
They don't like having to share the revenues. You know, they drive the revenues. They should get the lion's share. Why do they have to share it with all the other Premier League clubs and so on? it depends whether you take the market argument or whether you take the argument about the public health and the public value created by the way the leagues are structured and the history and everything.
And yet American sport is very much the opposite of that. The leagues are more powerful than the individual clubs.
Yes, it's very well regulated in America. But the reason for that is that it's virtuous because those franchises, the NFL franchises, the NBA franchises, the baseball franchise, they're worth a fortune and they're all in it together. But in America, it's much less dominance of the top teams.
Correct.
You know, nobody dominates.
Correct.
Here, the top five or six dominate. And the thing that helps them to dominate is the Champions League, where the rewards are so huge that you can't compete. If you're just below the top four or six competing for those places in the Champions League, you can't compete because they're getting another 20, 30, 40, 50 million from the Champions League. That's the difficulty.
Are we ever going to see a situation in which clubs like Charlton can get themselves together and get back into the Premier League and be a competitor the way Kirby should have them?
We're confident we're going to get into Europe soon. We're busy writing a song. No, a bit of stability and, you know, good football sense. There's no reason. We're a big club. We can sell out every week in the Premier League, no question at all. That whole area around Charlton, Greenwich, Blackheath, Woolwich, it's all been yuppified and gentrified. It's amazing. Transport links are absolutely sensational.
You've talked about it being gentrified, it being good. That's also the transformation, isn't it? That football used to be the sport of the working classes.
Yeah, very much.
And now is not so.
Well, it is still. It's a mixed crowd. You know, you go to Chelsea, there's a lot of hedge fund managers there. It's not like that at Charlton. We've got a few hedge cutters, but no hedge fund managers. But all those old newsreels of Wembley Cup finals and big matches, you know, the cloth caps and the fags and the whippets. Mm. But people are more affluent, generally speaking. Of course, there's always terrible poverty and deprivation, but by and large, people are more affluent today.
And do television controllers still feel that live football gives them an edge in the evening?
No question. If they can get hold of it, yeah, they can't afford it. They can't compete with Sky and Amazon and the others.
But it used to be cheap. I mean, relative to drama, sport was cheap.
Yes, cheaper than drama, yes. But not the volume that you get from drama. Your drama can fill an hour slot all the year round, new drama. You know, whether it's a 10-part series, a returning 20-part series, you know, you get volume. Football, other than Monday Night Football on Sky, by and large, it's too sporadic. There's not enough volume to go around.
Are you a positive fan of television in the sense that you believe television has been beneficial overall to the game?
No question.
Right.
In the old days, I'm talking showbiz here, you work round the music halls all year round, like Morecambe and Wise did in their early days. They'd get 40, 50 weeks a year at the Empire here and the Hippodrome there. But there came a point where if you weren't on television, you didn't exist.
Mm.
And television is a fantastic marketing device. You know, Alan Hardacre was always terrified of live league football. He thought it would kill the gate. He didn't understand that it would promote interest and it would never be a substitute for actually going to the game to see your team. But it was a fantastic shop window for the sport if the quality was good enough. And that's what the Premiership's proved. You know. I don't see the gates falling.
No, I don't either.
And those are big stadia now.
That's why I think, that, you know, it's the fans ultimately decide everything. It may be that they're being pushed that way by television, but ultimately, if the fans are there, they go.
On the other hand, if you'd put the Premier League idea to all the football fans throughout the country, they'd have probably voted against it. Mm. When you're visionary and you're ahead of people,
yeah,
you can't necessarily rely on their judgment until they've seen it. Once they've seen it, oh, that's great. I didn't know it was going to be as good as that. It's quite dangerous to ask the public. They're happy where they are. They love the status quo.
Yes, you're correct. I tried to change the name when I became chairman at Leicester. I thought it'd be a good idea because I'd always been quite envious of people who were Forest fans or Wednesday fans or whatever. That told you where they came from. That was their community. Whereas if you said, I'm a City fan, everybody thought you supported some wretched club next to United.
Oh, for heaven's sake. Just jealousy.
Jealousy, call it what you like. But I always thought it was quite nice. But The fans actually voted it down. I didn't manage to get that through. And the fact is, I don't think I could have done it. If you remember the guy at Hull tried to change the name, even though it's changing it to Tigers, which they were always known as.
Your problem, John, was that the name you chose, because no one's going to vote for Leicester Shitbags.
Guys, I've got a question for you. Do you think it's coincidence that Klopp's leaving Liverpool just when we've got a vacancy at Charlton?
Undoubtedly, yes. The new club in Saudi Arabia called Charlton Riyadh or something.
It could have been his secret dream. Even when he was at Borussia Dortmund, what he really wanted was Charlton Athletic, and he had to settle for Liverpool.
Absolutely.
Well, Michael, thank you very much for all this. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast. We've learned a lot about Charlton that we didn't know before, I have to say, and we've been thoroughly entertained. Aww. So thank you so much to Michael Grade for being our guest today, and as usual to Paddy and to John for their contributions, as ever, pertinent as they may or may not have been. And thank you to you for listening. And if you have, all Charlton supporters and others are welcome to let us know what they think about the programme, and they can do that by writing to footballruinmylife@gmail.com. We read them and we take them on board and we adjust accordingly. So until the next time, this is Colin Schindler saying thank you for listening. See you all next time on Football Ruin My Life. Cheerio!
I promise you this is true. In Dundee, we have the provincial branch of the V&A. You know, that building by the sea. And somebody said that a mate of his had seen Klopp in the V&A. He's obviously going to Dundee, but for the ultimate challenge.
No question.
Yeah.